Session number 28934, Len Trevelyan, part 9.
Len, you were telling us about the detective inspector in the Christie case.
Yes, as I said, he was a rather religious, straight-laced chap, and he couldn't bear the thought of talking or investigating the sordid necrophiliac side of Christie's career. But nevertheless, I realised that it was Mrs. Christie that was the chief active person in these murders, and that he was merely the accessory. And on one occasion, when the young cadets were doing the digging in the garden, I was in charge of taking the replacements up and arranging the duty rosters for the uniformed policemen outside. Walking through the house or into the garden, outside the back window of the little kitchenette or the back room, I saw a heap of rubbish, and on this heap of rubbish was a gold leaf cigarette tin, a gold leaf tobacco tin, you know, about inch and a half by 4 inches, something like that, and it was in quite new condition. So I idly picked it up and looked inside, and I found that it was packed full of clippings of hair, and I realised quickly that it was pubic hair clippings. So I handed this in to Mr. Black, and it eventually became an exhibit. And they identified clippings of hairs of all the subjects that they had investigation. And it became an exhibit in the Black Museum. But when I handed it in, it was packed full of clippings, and it must have represented the clippings from two or three dozen or even more than that bodies of hair, because it was packed tight with clippings of hair. Now, when years later, and they did the film, The Black Museum, I had a chance to look at that tin again, and it was just had a few samples of hair relating to the bodies that they had in the garden and the bodies they had under the stairs. In other words, the analysis at the laboratory had extracted the hairs belonging to the body that they had, but all the other hairs that must have been from numerous other bodies that had passed through their hands were removed. So I know that that case was reduced to the bare necessity of proving that case, and the evidence was there just for that purpose. So the real story, had it been dealt with by someone else other than Mr. Black, could have and possibly if it was dealt with in a different way, would have had to dealt with the murder of all those bodies. Because I spoke to Christie again in the cell. With a meal time, we had to take turns, every one of us, and I was talking to Christie, and it was he that revealed to me that he'd sooner take the full guilt of the job than talk about his wife's involvement and his involvement in the seduction of the bodies, or in the intercourse with the bodies, as he said. And but I mentioned this, but no one was interested, because the case was tied up. The case was all wrapped up with the evidence that they needed. So I've kept this evidence to myself till this time. I mean, I have mentioned it to other people, but not anyone who has had any ability to understand what was happening. And I know that that case would have been a very complicated one. Christie, I said, if you had more bodies than was in the garden and in the cupboard, he said, well, in those days, he said, the bomb sites, you could get rid of a body on a bomb site, and the rats and the dogs would get rid of it in no time at all. So no one has ever thought of checking on bodies found in bomb sites or even skeletons. They assume that it was people killed in air raids. So it could have been a very, very complicated and difficult case, and it still have only ended up in Christie's demise. But what a story for the the crime writers had this whole story got out. And then, I mean, I was on duty that period when in Heath, was it the RAX, well, the pretended RAF officer killed a girl in the corner of the square just behind, not Ladbroke Square, one of the squares there, one of the big houses, by sticking a riding crop into her vagina and killing her that way. You know, the horrible things, and the acid bath murder up in Kensington High Street. We lived amongst all of those, you know, investigations, and so it was a very time of active crime which we were involved in. But as I've said, the CID used to deal with all of those, and I and the vice squad used to deal with mine, and I got a number of commendations because one of my team was a chap, Bill Outram. He had been one of the middleweight boxers for the police, and Outram was an old time copper and could smell someone, a crooked bloke, from miles away. And when we used to go out, he said, "That bloke's got something." And we'd go up and stop a bloke and find he's a chef from a West End restaurant with steaks all tied around his legs, you know, or in his shirt, you know, all that sort of thing. And a bloke coming home with a 2-gallon tin of paint. He said, "I bet he's nicked that off where he's working." And sure enough, he had. We used to get charge after charge of minor crimes, but nevertheless, they were real crimes. And George Outram could smell it. There was a gang of old time crooks down Notting Hill, one of the back roads there. I forget their names now. The whole family grew up in crime, and I remember when the old Notting Hill police station was open. George was telling me this. They used to, when the policemen came out on parade, as we did in those days, march out on parade to our various beats and then peel off. George, on one occasion, put a pair of plimsolls on because one of the local crooks always used to take the mickey out of George, or out of the policeman. So old George put these plimsolls on. The next time, he gave chase to this bloke and caught him. And they, and in honourable style, he took his jacket off, hung it on the railings, and said to him, gave this bloke bloody good hiding. And he always got respect from all the blokes he nicked in those days because he could beat them, he could give them a good hiding. And they admired a copper who could take their jacket off and to give them a good hiding. So George was a great addition to my vice squad.
And Len, when was it you were promoted to inspector, and where did you go to from there?
When was it? 19... I went from Notting Hill. I did a spill. There was a vacancy at the training school for an instructor, which I put in for that and got accepted as an instructor at Hendon. And I did 3 years at Hendon from, was it about 45 to 48, something like that. And so I was a station sergeant by then up at Hendon. And when I'd finished the station, my 3 years at Hendon, I came out and did a little while as station sergeant. And I was on V Division. I went to Kingston, Richmond. But very quickly I became inspector at Kensington. And in fact, I stayed there for 9 years, not because I didn't have the opportunities of promotion, but because I didn't want it. At Kensington, very quickly they realised that some of the dockets that came in from VIPs and so on, complaints from the palace, and that I was able, through tact I suppose, was able to go and deal with them and prevent further incriminations being necessitating the documents to go up to the yard or anything like that. And so Commander Evans used to book out all his documents of complaint to me, and well, they were usually from VIPs when I got them, from the Kensington Palace or Marcus Seif, the head of Marks and Spencers, or not complaints, but requirements from Sir Winston Churchill in Hyde Park Place to do something. I was sent along to deal with the situation, and because Commander Evans didn't see the document anymore, I wasn't required to see it anymore, I could put a tab on it and put it away. I was kept on that job, and when my superintendent, Botwright, put me up for promotion several times and I went in to see Evans, he said to me, "Do you really want promotion?" He said it would entail weekend demonstrations, football matches, all that sort of things, and being in charge of all these disturbances, the things from Moseley riots, not that were Moseley then, but that sort of thing. He said, "You're a lot happier being an inspector here, aren't you?" So I said, "Yes, sir." And I carried on, and I had a sinecure of a job there. There was the Russian trade fair at Earl's Court, where Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, was coming over as a guest. I was put in charge of that, and put in charge of looking after Yuri and his personal guard, as it were, and showing him around and looking after him. And eventually I got his autograph, which I can show you, and things like that. So I got a lot of privileges by being the inspector there. And another thing, I was asked to go on to the management committee of a youth club in North Kensington, the Lancaster Youth Club, which was run by the Inner London Education Authority, but it was awfully troublesome. These little, the coloured boys were always in trouble up there and starting drug taking. And it wasn't very prevalent in those days, but they were always in trouble, because they were underprivileged, and the only way they could think of was fighting back against them, you know, showing their aggression. So anyway, I was asked to go onto this management committee, and the chairperson of this management committee was Philippa, Viscountess Astor. And she asked me to go as her deputy, a vice chairman. And we had school teachers. We had Father Bruce Kent, the CND chap, on the committee. And Betty Rose, whose husband was Jack Rose, the millionaire property developer. People like that were on this management committee. And we were always meeting, appointing new youth leaders and things like that, because things were going wrong or the club was being broken into. And I think the Inner London Educational Authority could have done without that youth club, because they were spending a lot of money on equipment that was being stolen and burglar alarms when it was broken into. But anyway, I had quite an enjoyable time there, and I often had to go, being deputy to Philippa Astor. She lived in St. Albans Crescent, I think it was, somewhere behind Barker's there. Used to have to go and see her and discuss the next minutes for the next meeting and so on. And she had a little daughter, Emily, who was 3 or 4 years old. And of course she had no father to look after her, or because her father was Viscount Astor, who'd had the affair with a model, I forget her name, and Philippa Astor had divorced him. So little Emily was alone with her mother, and I think she enjoyed having a man in the house to play with her and pay attention to her. And an amusing incident on one occasion, well, it was amusing to some people, was when little Emily went out to the the policeman standing on the next house. It was a minor embassy, but had a policeman guarding it. And she went to this embassy, a policeman, and said, "Do you know Inspector Trevelyan?" And he said, "Oh, yes, he's our inspector back at Kensington." She said, "You know, he often comes in and sees my mummy at night." Well, you can imagine the reception I got when I went back to the Nick after that tour of duty. Anyway, it was very pleasant. There was no... everyone realised what I was doing, and the commander himself, you know, gave me freedom to do these sort of things. In fact, Father Bruce Kent asked me if I would mind giving lectures to the girls at the Catholic school in the square behind Bend, or behind Barker's, I forget the name of the school, and there was in charge of nuns. And because they knew that I'd been on the vice squad, their chief interest was in me telling them about the vice squad, and I used to do what I used to do, and with the prostitutes, and how we used to chase them, and so on. And the girls asked more about the prostitution than they did about the rest of the crime that I got involved with. They were more interested in that. Anyway. Father Bruce Kent, he was a good lad, and I know he was a CND chap, but he wasn't, I think he was more in it for the publicity he got than anything else. I shouldn't say that, in case anyone ever hears it. But Betty Rose, one of the committee members, she had two sons whose bar mitzvah came up during my period there, and of course Betty Rose was very friendly with me and always on the phone to her, although she was one of these persons that you could, when you heard her on the phone, you could say hello Betty and put the receiver down and go and do the washing up and come back and hear the rest of her story then. But Betty Rose invited Eve and I to the bar mitzvah, which was at the Grosvenor House, and they lived in a big block on the penthouse of a big block called Kensington Court opposite Royal Garden Hotel, and I'll tell you more about the Royal Garden Hotel later on, but they lived in this block of flats in front of the hotel, and being a millionaire, I know he denoted $1 million each to his two sons, these twin sons on their bar mitzvah, and they had a lot of very wealthy friends in the property development business, names that were in those days household names and press names that you met in the press every time, you know, as the millionaire class. And but when Eve and I went up to the reception for their sons, we were met in the foyer by Betty and Jack, and Betty said to Eve, she said, Eve, my bloody feet are killing me. She said, "Where did you get that dress from, Eve?" And she was wearing a Dior. She said, "I'd sooner wear that than this bloody thing I paid thousands for from Dior." Yeah, and she was that sort of bloke. She was that sort of person. Anyway, the next day to the bar mitzvah, I had a phone call from them. It was 2 days afterwards. She said, "Len, we've been broken into." She said, "Can you come up and see us?" And I went up, and what had happened was, they'd had a phone. She had a maid and a butler in the house. Someone had phoned the maid, or the butler was it, and said, "Your mum and dad have been involved in an accident on their way to the airport to see off their guests, and they're in hospital in Hammersmith Hospital." So the butler and the maid bundled the two boys into the car and went off tearing off to Hammersmith Hospital. But when they tried to find what was Hammersmith Hospital, they realised Hammersmith had a number of hospitals, and they couldn't find out where it was. But this was merely an excuse to get the family out of the house, because while they were out, the house was ransacked, and all the boys bar mitzvah presents and everything. And, you know, it's usually money in those cases was stolen. And so Jack and Betty had this tragedy immediately after the boy's bar mitzvah. It was a dampener on the whole story. But Jack and Betty phoned me up later on, out of my police capacity, and said, "Can we come and see you then? We're so fed up and tensed up about this loss." And they drove down and parked at this house out with a big Rolls Royce outside and came in. It was September time, I think. And we took them in the garden and gave cups of tea out in the patio there. And the little boys walked into the garden, and my Cox's orange pippin was full of fruit. And these little boys said, "Are they apples? Can we have an apple?" I said, "Yes, which one?" And they, of course, wanted the very top one on the tree. So I let it them. And I said to Jack, "Haven't you got a garden? Haven't you got a country house or anything where these boys can have a garden?" They said, "No, this is the first time I've seen fruit growing on a tree." Millionaires, and they got the pleasure of these boys of picking an apple off a tree. And Jack and Betty came in, and they said, "This is the most relaxing time we've had since the burglary." And I said, "Well, if you've got any sense, Jack, you'll buy a country house and you'll go and live in the country and take your two young lads to get a bit of fresh air and life away from the town." Whether they did or not, I don't know. So that was another event while I was an inspector at Kensington.
Now, what happened towards the end of your career and sort of what took you on out of the service?
Well, within a few months of finishing my 30 years service, Commander Evans called me in and he said, "Len," he said, "I've got someone here wants to talk to you to see if you will do a special job for us." And it turned out that because I had, during my tenure at Kensington, had entry into all the embassies, you know, including the Russian embassy and the Romanian embassy and the Israeli embassy, my calls used to take me into them for every, I got invitation to their receptions and so on. And even I went to a number of the receptions with, full gear on. And met ambassadors and attaches and all that sort of thing. So the superintendent said to me, he said, it really is to go to the newly being built the Royal Garden Hotel. He said they want a security guard there, a security officer there, to deal with the problems that they might arise from Kensington Palace, because the scaffolding of the new hotel has got to be in Palace Avenue, which Princess Margaret drives along, and the Kents and so on, and we're sure to get complaints. Will you go along and act in the role of, you'll get a security officer's role, and have authority to, you know, to organise things? He said, but there's also another aspect of it is security. Security regarding the Russian embassy. He said, I didn't quite understand what he was getting at. So he said, it's a very nice job. He said, I advise you to take it. So I said, well, I'm losing 1/40 of my pension. He said, it'll be more than made up with what you get from this job. So I took it. And I saw from the grand hotel build up from a hole in the ground right up until it was ready, some of the floors were ready for occupation. And this was 1966. The first customer, the big customer we had in, was the Bolshoi Ballet. They'd taken up the whole of the floor of the newly erected hotel. The top floors hadn't been completed, but the Bolshoi Ballet took over a whole floor of the Royal Garden Hotel. And it was then that I realized why I had been put into the hotel, because very soon I met persons from another organization that wanted me to help them in identifying people that came in. And I might as well tell you, it's no secret now that it was MI5 that wanted me in their ranks working for them inside the hotel to assist them in their identifying visitors from the Russian embassy and so on. And
were you on their payroll?
I was on the payroll of the hotel, or so I believed. But there was a certain gentleman that used to visit me, and eventually, by the way, during that during 1966, one of our functions that we were putting on was the victorious banquet for the victorious English football team, Bobby Moore and all of them, and just prior to that, the Charles Remey Cup had been lost, if you remember, and the little dog Pickles had found it. Well, that once it was recovered and it was put into my possession, into my hands, in my security room, my security office at the hotel, and I looked after the Charles Remey World Cup. When the team arrived, I remember I took them up onto the first floor and through a little window, which was for not for public, but I took them onto the balcony overlooking the street and presented the whole team to the world at large from the balcony of the hotel. I've got a number of rockets from architects and people like that, because they said we never tested that balcony for stress of crowds on it. Anyway, that went down very well, and all I had to do on that occasion was phone up the Nick and say, I need half a dozen lads to come up and give me a hand. It'll be a fiver each for you. And I could have got the whole station if I really wanted. They came up and helped the banquet, and they would have done that for me on any occasion. And so I had a very good working relationship with the lads of the Nick. And they were only too pleased to come and get associated with the World Victoria Cup team. And was it Rouse, one of the managers, the organisers? He gave me a cut glass beaker that was presented to each member of the team. So I've got one of the cut glass beakers. I haven't got it now. I gave it to my daughter and son-in-law up in Aberdeen. But they've got a cut crystal glass beaker that the only other people was one of the victorious 96 English team. So this was another highlight of my stay at the hotel. At any rate, again, after the job had been completed and the hotel had been equipped with all its equipment and television sets safely delivered, the Royal Lancaster Club had a similar experience being built. When the equipment was delivered there through the front door, it was delivered out into other lorries at the back door. They lost half the stuff going into there, but I, being a little shrewder and aware of what was happening, I made sure that because I appointed my own doorkeepers and so on, I made sure that every item that came in was accounted for and didn't go out again. And I got very pleasant letters and gratification from the chairman, Instone Bloomfield, and the board of directors of the hotel, and was put on managerial strength, you know, so I used to dine in the dining rooms with the managers and so on. It was a very, very pleasant stay there. But enough is enough, and I decided that when I retired from the police force, I intended to retire for good, but this was another few years on, and I thought, well, I'm now retired for good again. So I came home to Eve, and I said, look, I'm going to take 2 or 3 weeks leave. We'll go down to the West Country and take 2 or 3 weeks, or 2 or 3 months if necessary, to find a lovely place to live. We'll retire into the country. And we hadn't, we'd been living in this house ever since 1948, and we'd bought up our 2 girls. They were off our hands, and we didn't want to stay in it any longer, and so we thought we'd retire to the country and get away from it all. And I said, we'll have a nice 2 or 3 weeks break, or 2 or 3 months, whatever it is, until we find something, and then we'll retire. While we were waiting, before we went away, a letter arrived through the post, a nice big buff envelope, and inside it was an intriguing letter from the Ministry of Defence. They said that they'd heard of my retirement from the hotel, And would I go to room 055, the War Office, for an interview as they thought they had a position of interest, a position which would interest me? So I thought, well, what can this be? And I realized that I thought Special Branch had been involved in this, and the person I'd been dealing with I thought was Special Branch, but I realized it wasn't Special Branch. It was one of a representative of that MI5 that had been coming to see me all through my time at the hotel for various matters. Anyway, I said to Eve, look, I must go up for this interview, and it's not until a fortnight's time we can go and get at least a week's break away from home. So I went away with Eve for a week and came back, and then went up to this interview, which I found was in order for me to join MI5, because they thought that my experience at the hotel and my knowledge of the various embassies and so on around, particularly the Russian embassy, which I'd had access to as a sergeant, you know, an inspector at Red Army Day and places like that. I used to go in and drink their vodka and sample their fish and things like that. So that they realized that I was would be useful to them, and so they asked me if I would join, and I sort of jumped at it and said yes. I didn't know what it entailed, and I did join them, and I think from now on my experiences with them are something that I shall keep to myself. But I had a very interesting 8 or 9 years with them, and eventually at the age of 65 I retired, and have been retired since. And I think I'm drawing police pension longer than anyone I know.
Longer than you paid into it.
Longer than I paid into it. In fact, when I had a hip operation a few years ago, and at the end of it, I'd lost my wife, and I lost my wife 7 years ago now. And this, I had my new hip about 5 years ago, and wasn't making much progress at home. And someone suggested that why don't I try and get the police nursing home to take me? Well, the police nursing home had moved to Flint House down at Goring on Thames. So I made an application, and they said, well, we do allow 1% of uniform officers to retired officers to come. Yes, we'll give you a place. And so I went down to Goring-on-Thames for 10 days or so, and had all their facilities of their recuperative baths and the physiotherapy and the whole lot, and had a wonderful time there. But when the serving officers who were there heard how long I'd been on pension, they were bloody envious, and I used to have to talk to them all about it and how I'd survived and what I did and so on. So I've gotten into the habit of talking about things, and I sometimes think I ought to shut up and say less than I do today. But anyway, I've had a wonderful career, and I've missed out many episodes that I've thought about, you know, that were intriguing. But when you're trying to talk and think at the same time, it's a job to put them all together.